If you would like to work directly with Dr. Cole to maximize your sleep quality with a comprehensive sleep coaching program, or if you're concerned that you have sleep apnea, or simply just want a second opinion consultation, she's now available to see patients in New Jersey, New York, California, and Georgia, with more states coming soon. Please visit oak.care/sleep for a complete list of telemedicine services with transparent pricing. You deserve rapid access to quality sleep care with a physician you can trust to have your back every step of the way on your journey to better sleep.
Hi, I'm Dr. Allison Cole, sleep medicine specialist and bona fide chronic insomniac. Welcome to the Sleep is My Waking Passion podcast. Remember, knowledge is empowerment, and if applied correctly, it can help you biohack your way to a better night of sleep, just like I did. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Sleep is My Waking Passion podcast. You know who I am. I'm your host. And today I am really excited to introduce to you Jen Walsh. She is a sleep scientist, a true diehard researcher. She gave a fabulous TED Talk that I happened to run upon when I was scrolling through the internet, probably later than I should have been. Jen, I just loved your talk on cannabis and sleep. So the focus today is really going to be getting into the weeds a bit with sleep and cannabis. I had written a chapter, co-authored it for Integrative Medicine. It's a textbook for Andrew Weil. And this was a number of years ago. And since that time, Jen has actually published some research that I really wanted to talk to you guys about. Jen, welcome. It is such a pleasure to have you. I know it's quite early for you in Australia, speaking to me from there. So welcome.
Thanks, Allison. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's great to be joining you on a podcast that I listen to.
Yes. When you told me that, I was so, so tickled. So you are director for the Center of Sleep Science. Did I say that correctly?
That's right. And we spell center the opposite way to the way you would spell it. So it's center with an R-E, not an E-R.
Oh, I love that. That just sounds so much more eloquent than us crazy Americans over here. So we're going to kind of get into the weeds a little bit. I want you to share your beautiful brain with everyone. One of the things we talked about before we started was I really wanted to speak with you because you truly have a scientific mind when it comes to the subject matter. This is not really a pro-con discussion at all. It's just what the literature really shows and how it relates to sleep. And I think it's particularly important because one of the main reasons that people ask me about it as a sleep doctor is, hey, is this going to help my sleep? And they're curious about things like, okay, so what dosing is out there? And, you know, do I take CBD or just THC and the combinations? And staying away from sort of the political issues, which are simply that it really wasn't studied for a very long time, right? Because it was illegal. Now we actually need to be able to make recommendations. Things are moving faster in the economic world, people opening up dispensaries, et cetera. But the science sort of has really lagged behind. What do you think? Do you agree with that? Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. And the landscape is so different, I think, in different parts of the world. So In the US, I know that you have dispensaries, you know, depending upon what state you live in, You know, you can go and buy different products. You know, you don't need to really do anything. You just, I don't even know whether you even need to be over 18. Hopefully you do, but in Australia, you still can't buy it without a prescription. And it's not, I guess it's getting easier to get the prescription, but it's still not super straightforward. You know, it's harder and the products are quite expensive in Australia. And I know that the same in New Zealand. I know it's very similar in the UK. So it's really different. I think that that's why in Australia, we've been able to do a bit more research because I guess it's more accessible in the US. It's more accessible for people just to go and purchase it and treat themselves. I think that it's harder to do the research as well. There's a bit of legislation around doing research with cannabis products. And I think you can probably perhaps set me straight if I've said something incorrect there.
What I will tell you is I'm not sure how much some of this stuff costs. That I haven't really looked into. But what I would say is, yeah, it's been a challenge. The only person I really knew was doing some really sort of true research in it for many, many years was a gentleman named Donald Tashkin, who was a pulmonologist, I believe, over at UCLA. And he had published a lot of things on his experience, looking even at doing a procedure called a bronchoscopy, where they take some bites and look at tissue under the microscope and just look at things like how inhalational exposure to cannabis can potentially negatively impact lung function. So he's the one guy that I know was doing it even when it was illegal. Like, I don't know how he got all those grants to do it, but he managed to find a way. So part of the old guard there. I'm going to just quickly give you guys sort of a brief history of cannabis. This was something that was an addition in the chapter in the integrative medicine book that I co-authored. But it's kind of neat because what I didn't realize was some of the companies that are out there that are pharmaceutical companies, like in the 1800s, 1900s, they actually were producing marijuana for people to take for medicinal purposes. And then in like the 1930s, they started having this tax act. And then by the 1970s, it was, you know, then deemed to be illegal. So I actually didn't know any of that backstory. I didn't know in the 1800s and 1900s, it just was no biggie, you know, to get this stuff. So that was sort of an eye-opening experience for me, I would say. Jen, before we get started, just in terms of the real sleep stuff, I was hoping that you could share with everyone what we understand about the cannabis plant and, you know, what chemicals are we looking at? What are the general classes of things that are being explored in the research?
Yeah, so it's really complicated. I guess most people, when they think of cannabis or marijuana, whatever you want to call it, pot, they do think of the plant. And, you know, the plant's got components, it's got leaves, it's got stalks, it's got flowers, and it's got the buds of the plant as well. When we're talking about cannabis, we're talking about, I guess, using it in a medicinal way as opposed to in a recreational way. We're talking about either using parts of the plant, so the leaf or the flower, and it's dried, it's consumed one way or another, and that changes how it has an effect as well. And we're using parts of the plant to have an effect. And within those parts of the plant, whether it's the leaf, the flower, the bud, whatever, we can extract, or there are different components and they have different effects. So there are what we call the cannabinoids. There are a number of different cannabinoids. There is the THC, which you've talked about, the CBD. So THC is delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol. CBD is cannabidiol. And then one of the other quite well-known cannabinoids, I guess, is cannabinol. But these are just three, and there's about 100, depends which piece of literature you read as to how many there are. I've heard numbers from 70 up to, I think, about 140. So somewhere in the 100 range of different cannabinoids. Those three are probably the most well studied, and they're the ones that we, I guess, understand a little bit more about how they work and the effects that they have. Then within the cannabis plant, I should also say there's other components which probably have an effect that is potentially beneficial in terms of our health or the effect that it has on our physiology. But yet that's not really studied well either. So we can't really say exactly what all of those other different chemical constituents actually are doing. You know, we can't say definitively at this point. So yeah, that's, I guess, cannabis. That's the what we call the phytocannabinoids that are derived from the cannabis plant. So that's one type of cannabinoid. Hmm. But then there's two other types. One of them is one that is produced within our own body. So these are called the endocannabinoids. So our body actually makes its own, and they act throughout the body and have, I guess, similar effects as to what the cannabis or the phytocannabinoids have if we consume cannabis from the plant. However, it's to a much lesser degree. We don't feel the effects as much. They're called the endocannabinoids. And then we also have synthetic cannabinoids. And these have been manufactured to mimic the effects of the endocannabinoids or the phytocannabinoids, usually the phytocannabinoids.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's quite complicated.
And then can I ask maybe a silly question, but, you know, where do terpenes, I've heard this term terpenes, where do the terpenes fit into all of this?
Yeah. So the terpenes are one of those other components of the cannabis plant that are non-cannabinoids.
Okay.
That's what they are. And there's hundreds of those as well. when you have a cannabis product, you can choose to have what they call the isolate, where you have just the THC alone or the CBD alone, or maybe you've got a combination of the THC and the CBD, but that's it. You don't have any of the other chemical compounds that would be found naturally in the cannabis plant, and they would include the terpenes. Whereas you could have also what they call a full spectrum, which is where you have everything. You know, it's the whole plant, including the cannabinoids, the minor cannabinoids that we actually don't usually quantify, and then those terpenes.
Talk about complicated. I'm like, I think you're doing a marvelous job trying to explain it. Basically, it's a plant with a ton of components here. You can imagine how challenging it is, guys, when you're listening to this, to actually study this in a way that's meaningful and somewhat rigorous, I would argue. So the endocannabinoid system in our body, do we know what its purpose is? I know that we talk about it being related to the fact that we have one. And so when we consume, you know, marijuana products, that may be one of the reasons that it helps with pain control and things, as we know, is sort of a known effect of it. Can you elaborate on that at all?
Yeah. So I think it's only in the last, is it 30 or 40 years that we've really known that there is actually an endocannabinoid system. This is where how our endocannabinoids interact with that system, but also any cannabinoids that we consume, you know, orally or whichever form, however we're consuming them, it's how they have their effect. Yeah, in terms of the purpose, I mean, I feel like it's limitless in terms of the evidence that's coming out. It seems to have an effect on almost every system. So, you know, reproductive. There's receptors in our reproductive system. There's receptors, obviously lots of them in our brain, in our nervous system. It has effects on inflammation, on immune function. Yeah, I think it's just about everything. Digestion.
It's really like another part of our system. It's like an added, just like our nervous system, cardiovascular system. We try to classify everything, but it's just part of our existence that we just, it's fascinating to me that we just learned about it like 30, 40 years ago. Wow. It's amazing how time flies when you're studying this stuff. What we do know is that many people have reported various effects of consuming cannabis-like products. And these can be anti-inflammatory. They could help your GI. Some people have a lot of issues with abdominal spasms, and this could be antispasmodic for that. It can have appetite stimulating, but also appetite suppressing effects, which I've always found very fascinating that it could kind of have both. Analgesic, so it could serve for pain control. It can be sedating, which is why some people have been studying it for insomnia. And back in the 1800s, that's one of the indications that people took it for. It can help with nausea. So we've definitely know that we use this often for people with poor appetite, such as if they're undergoing chemotherapy or have cancer, for example. It can help with anxiety, but I would argue that some forms may actually make anxiety worse, depending. It can have anticonvulsant, antioxidant properties. I'm probably not naming them all. I know I am not. But I think really what our focus then is going to move on just sort of how it affects sleep. And that's a really broad topic, guys, because when you break it down, it's not like we can give you one cookie cutter answer regarding sleep, because there's different sleep disorders and certain issues that we have with our sleep may actually potentially have better data for it than other areas. It's pretty complicated, as Jen eloquently put it. Very simply put, this is some deep stuff that we're going to talk about. So can you tell us a bit about sleep architecture? So I have reviewed this on the podcast before, guys, and normal sleep architecture, we typically have we go into a light stage one sleep. That's not a very long time. Then we have stage two non-rapid eye movement sleep. Then we have deep or delta wave sleep, which is stage three non-rapid eye movement sleep. And then we have rapid eye movement sleep. And, you know, generally speaking, we're looking at about 25% rapid eye movement sleep, about 20-ish or so percent slow wave sleep, just generally speaking. The amount changes, but just to give you a sense of the architecture, when we're looking at certain components of how it would affect our sleep architecture, that is what we're talking about. So Jen, I'm going to let you take it away, because there's been some new stuff since I wrote my chapter.
It's so complicated because there are these different cannabinoids. There are different ways in which you can consume it, and that has different effects as well. I would say broadly, we do know that in terms of getting to sleep, what we call sleep latency, that cannabinoids in general probably help with reducing sleep latency. We know that there's mixed evidence. I guess more studies show that it reduces the amount of REM sleep than the studies that show that it either has no effect or it increases REM. It probably decreases the amount of REM sleep. And then it may also decrease the amount of time that people spend awake during the night, so which is what we call wake after sleep onset. And it may increase the amount of non-REM 3 sleep, so that deep sleep. The evidence is really sparse. If you take a population of people who have, for example, a high proportion of REM sleep, it may have a different effect on that group. And if you take a population who have poor sleep, you know, people who have insomnia, for example, then it may have a different effect on that group than for someone who has healthy sleep. And I think that's been part of the problem so far with the studies that we have. You know, the studies themselves, a lot of them are quite good. They may have used really robust techniques for measuring sleep, but they may have studied a population which has healthy sleep to start with. So if someone has healthy sleep, or what we would describe as normal sleep, you know, would we expect to see an improvement on that? If we think that cannabis or cannabinoids are going to improve sleep. So, yeah, I think it's tricky. As I said, complicated. I might use that word a lot. And I think the other problem is that where a lot of the studies have combined people perhaps with a sleep problem with another health disorder or another medical condition like pain, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, something like that. And so it's likely to have a different effect in those groups than it is in a group of people just with pure insomnia, with what we would call primary insomnia. I think I've described probably in general what we would see, what we think is the evidence is showing us at this point, but there's just so many caveats that whether each of the cannabinoids, and even if you combine them, whether they have that effect in everyone is unknown at this point.
To your point, in selecting or talking about patient population, some of the studies that I looked at from, and these are not new studies, these are from back in the day, if you will, some of them were kind of tailored toward looking at people who were either the opposite of what many of the people listening might be, which are really chronic users, people who may have heavy cannabis use or chronic use. And while I think all of it's relevant, particularly since some of those folks have demonstrated that their sleep gets worse when they're withdrawing off cannabis, that there's relevance to that data. But it is hard to be able to extrapolate that to, you know, an average person who wants to either try it intermittently. And then the issue becomes, okay, what defines, in my mind, what defines chronic? Are you somebody who is essentially sort of imbibed or under the influence, if you will, all day long? Is it someone who only uses it at nighttime? What happens over a long period of time? And it's a little bit hard to afford to do the study, let alone get people to cooperate with doing a study where you're sort of trying to test the hypothesis of how their sleep architecture is. And you're like, okay, you're going to be on this for a year and then we're going to see. I'm hoping that those large studies are up and coming and going to provide some clarity.
That's a huge problem. And I think that contributes to a lot of the stigma that remains around the use of cannabis for medicinal purposes, is that a lot of the evidence that we have, and there is a lot of negative evidence, negative outcomes from using cannabis recreationally and using it chronically. As I said, I think it does contribute to the stigma. I think that people who are using cannabis for medicinal purposes are probably using it in much lower doses and perhaps less frequently, but maybe in some cases more frequently. But they certainly, for the most part, are using it in lower doses and using it in a more controlled way. They're also consuming products. Certainly in Australia, the way it works is that the products that you purchase for medicinal use, we know what's in them. for the most part, we know what the active components are. We know what the proportion of THC or the concentration of THC, we know the concentration of CBD. So we can control it and monitor the effects in a more controlled way.
Along those lines, I figured I would talk about insomnia because, like we were mentioning, that's one of the most common reasons that people ask about it is the trouble sleeping. Now, you had commented that the data sort of here and there, and it seems like some data looks favorable, other data maybe not so much. I did actually want to bring up your study because you were involved in a study and it was, I'll let you kind of take it away with that. But you had some interesting outcomes because I feel like the subjective data that you achieved from your study didn't necessarily align with any of the polysomnogram or sleep study findings. And to me, that's really interesting because we have what we know about sleep architecture based on these, a lot of electrodes on your head monitoring your brain waves while you sleep. And yet, yeah, I was curious about that. It didn't seem to match up with what patients said. So fire away, please tell us about this.
Maybe I should preface it with there have been a number of studies which have looked at the effects of cannabinoids in patients with insomnia. That was specifically, I guess, the aim of our study was to look at the effects of a particular formulation in people with insomnia. But the previous studies, I guess, that have been done, very few of them have used robust, I guess, techniques to measure sleep. One of them, for example, was the way they assessed sleep was having someone who was what they called an experienced observer walk into the room while the patient was sleeping and ascertain whether or not they're asleep by just looking at them. Fortunately, we have more sophisticated measures of or methods of measuring sleep. There have been a handful of studies that have been done with mixed results. Our study was done, it started around 2018, 2019. It was the first trial actually in Western Australia involving a cannabinoid. So there was a lot of bureaucracy to overcome.
You did it!
Yeah, it was quite an achievement. And what we did was we took patients, there were 24, who had what we described as, they weren't diagnosed with insomnia, but they had symptoms of insomnia. So one of the measures that we use to, I guess, quantify symptoms of insomnia is the Insomnia Severity Index. And so people had to have an Insomnia Severity Index of at least 10, which indicates mild insomnia. And they had to have no other major health conditions and no other sleep disorder. So it was really sort of primary insomnia. And we did a baseline period. So it was a 2-week baseline period where they had nothing and they wore a wristwatch, which measured an actigraph, which measured their sleep. They had to fill out a sleep diary while they were at home. And at the end of the 2 weeks, they came into our sleep laboratory and we measured their sleep with polysomnography. So with all the wires.
Pause for 1 second. I'm just going to add to the folks that are listening. So an actigraph has been, if you can't get someone into a sleep lab, it's really been a huge important tool used in research. It is really monitoring movement. And so we're extrapolating data from the movement data that it gives us, but it's been validated. And just so you're aware, it looks like Respironics is no longer going to support the actigraph anymore. So from the researcher side, that I'm going to be curious to see how y'all decide you're going to measure things moving forward because you need something, right, in order to have more robust data. But guys, that's what an actigraph is. My apologies. I just wanted people to follow our conversation.
As you pointed out, the limitation is that it measures movement or lack of movement to quantify sleep. But it is very useful when you're measuring sleep over a long period of time, like in someone over 2 weeks with insomnia at home. So it's used quite commonly in insomnia research. We did that. They then had a week, what we call washout, because at the end of the baseline period, we gave them what we call a sensitivity dose. So we gave them a small amount of a mixture of the active and placebo medication so we could see whether they were going to have any kind of adverse reaction to the cannabinoids. Because there's a small group of people who will react negatively to cannabis. And we didn't want to have someone having that effect when they were at home. Then they had a week washout. They had 2 weeks then where they took either the active or the placebo medication. They didn't know what they were taking and we didn't know. So it was a double blind study. And they did the same measures, so the diary, the actigraph, and the PSG on night 14. Then they came back in, they had another week washout, and they crossed over to the opposite for a further 2 weeks. It was quite an involved study, a big commitment from people. The final result was that our primary outcome measure was the Insomnia Severity Index. The reason for choosing that as the primary outcome measure is that insomnia is a subjective disorder. We can't tell someone, oh, well, you're only getting 5 hours sleep, it took you more than 30 minutes to fall asleep last night, therefore you've got insomnia. Or you were awake for an hour in the middle of night, oh, you've got insomnia. If they don't perceive that that's a problem for them, then it's actually not insomnia. If it's not impacting their life, it's not insomnia. And so the ISI accounts for that subjective component of the insomnia condition. So that was our primary outcome measure. Secondary outcome measures were safety, obviously, and the outcomes according to the sleep diary and the actigraphy, and then the polysomnography. So what we found was that when they were taking the active medication, and I'll come back and tell you what was in the active medication because I haven't mentioned that yet. When they were taking the active medication, their ISI decreased quite significantly. It was 5.1 units, which is probably the borderline for clinical significance in terms of that metric. The subjective measures of sleep, according to the sleep diary, they reported that they felt that they slept better. They reported sleeping longer and waking less during the night. They subjectively felt that they were sleeping better. They felt that they were waking more refreshed in the morning as well. And then in terms of the objective measures, from the actigraphy, there was a reduction in the amount of time that they spent awake during the night and an increase in the total amount of time that they spent asleep. So that aligned with the subjective measures.
Okay, fair enough. We have an actigraph.
Yeah.
We have objective aligning with subjective.
Yeah. And both of those were measured, I guess the diary and the actigraphy was being used for 2 weeks at home. You know, it was done over the entire 2 weeks. The PSG was done only on a single night. As you alluded to, the PSG results didn't align with the actigraphy results or the diary results. So we're like, oh, well, did it work or did it not? So in terms of the PSG results, there was basically no difference. It didn't make it worse, their sleep worse, but it didn't look like it had improved it in terms of the time taken to fall asleep or the total amount of sleep that they had over the night.
And the sleep architecture, I think, was sort of also really not much different, if I recall.
That's right. Yeah. There was a slight, it was insignificant, but there was a slight reduction in the amount of REM sleep that people had. It actually was, what was it? Something, there was a change in the amount of sleep that they had during the placebo night as well. So basically it was insignificant. But there was a trend, and some people have focused on that trend and, oh, well, this means that, you know, there's less REM sleep. And I think that I would say, no, there was no effect with this particular formulation on that one night in this population. It was insignificant.
I just am tickled with how well designed you guys really went out of your way to really try to get as much data as possible and objective data. And my review has been an awful lot of questionnaires, and to your point, random things like, hey, we had a sleep person watching you, and I don't even know what that is. Like, that's not a real thing. So kudos to you guys. And just so you guys are aware, there is something called a first night effect with polysomnogram. So if I hook you up to like 30 electrodes and wires all over your body, and then I tell you to go to sleep, many people may not sleep as well as they would at home. But if I bring you in and hook you up and then I charge you for it, the cost difference of doing a study like that is substantially different than actigraphy or even home sleep testing. So I just wanted to point that out. Just really, really, I think you guys did the best you could in the most economical fashion. So kudos. I thought it was a bang up job.
The study was actually, I guess, initiated by a company that wanted to test the product that they had. And they were prepared to do a really solid study, which is fantastic because I'm a scientist, I'm a researcher, and I want to do the best possible study that we can in order to test, you know, whatever product it is. So this particular formulation had, at the maximum dose, so people could either choose a single dose or a double dose, 10 milligrams of THC, 1 milligram of cannabinol, CBN, and 0.5 milligram of CBD. So it was a high THC product. And they could take, so as I said, it was 14 nights, and they could take it for the first 3 nights, they had to take the single dose. After that, if they wanted to, they could double the dose. So just over half of them doubled the dose. And obviously, when they were taking the placebo, they didn't know, you know, that it was placebo. So they could choose to double the dose of that as well. And, you know, our thinking was, well, if the placebo is not working, then everyone would double the dose. But it didn't turn out like that. I think it was 14 of them doubled the dose with the active medication and 16 doubled with placebo or something like that. It was very similar. It's hard to extrapolate the findings to other results where they've used a different formulation. And that's one of the challenges. It's one of the exciting components or exciting parts doing research in this area as well, is that there's almost like a limit. There is a limitless number of different combinations and formulations that you could look at to see, you know, what effect they're having. There is, I guess, some evidence that the THC is the cannabinoid that people associate with being high. So it's got an potentially has an intoxicating effect. Some people call it psychoactive. I prefer to use intoxicating because I think that the CBD, CBN also, you know, even though they're considered perhaps non-intoxicating, they probably have psychoactive components as well, because CBD in particular, we know, has some anti-anxiety properties, which in my mind is a psychoactive effect.
The CBN, what sort of effect does that have? Because the CBD, I think I kind of get. And anxiolytic, used a lot for pain control specifically, doesn't really have that psychoactive component. What is the CBN? I guess a lot of people are familiar with it. That one was new to me.
Yeah, so it's definitely not as well studied. It's thought to have a sleep promoting effect as well. Beyond that, I actually don't know. But I know that early on it was combined with THC, and it was, so in a study, oh, I think it was in the 70s, from memory, I think they had a single night where they had THC alone. They had another night where they combined it. Actually, I don't even think it was at nighttime, it was daytime, but it made people feel more sedated. And it has been used, I guess, in clinics, particularly in the US, I know, where it's experienced prescribers using, have prescribed it and have had patients with reported benefits from combining CBN with CBD and THC. A combination of the early evidence, that's a single study which was published, plus, I guess, anecdotal experience was what drove this particular formulation, I guess, the foundation of the formulation.
And that actually is a great point that you're making here, because the different plants, there's different types. There's cannabis sativa and indica, and these different types of plants, maybe you could verify this, but my guess is that they have different components of each. Like one might have a little bit more of that, a little bit less of that. And so certain strains are supposed to be more associated with sleep versus other strains.
Yeah. And that's a whole other minefield. Complexity.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I think that, you know, sativa and indica, you know, you can have the same amount of THC in them. You know, you could have a, I guess, a pile of sativa, a pile of indica, and they could each have the same amount of THC and CBD, but they will have different effects.
Wow.
That's where it gets really, really complex.
Then it becomes, well, is there something that we're actually not studying? Because we keep teasing out these different components we think are the most important. Maybe there's something else, like some magic sauce that we're not aware of within that. It's a plant, you know? So it's real complex.
It's not going to be surprising, though, with all the other constituents of the plant. Surely, you know, we're just learning more and more every day about the effects that, you know, what's in them and, you know, the effects that they're having. It's such a minefield. I just don't know how we're going to be able to really, I guess, identify, you know, all of the effects that each of the plants have. And then also when you're working with humans, because we're all different and we respond differently to the same medication. And I mean, it's beyond just cannabis. You know, you can give someone melatonin, 2 milligrams of melatonin, and it can have a different effect in 2 different people.
I'm glad that someone like you is going out on a limb and really trying to study this as much as possible and give more information, because it is a very tricky question to try to answer for patients when I'm asked various questions about it, you know, and it comes up a lot. So thank you so much for your time. This has been super, super rad. We haven't even begun to touch base on things like obstructive sleep apnea. There's been some research there, REM behavior disorder, also post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, you had actually commented, which I found fascinating, narcolepsy and idiopathic hypersomnia, because clinically relevant is, just so you guys know, and you should be aware of this, if you are someone who is used to imbibing some form of a cannabis product and you have narcolepsy or idiopathic hypersomnia, it's very difficult when we test you, because there may be a true sleep disorder there, but guess what? There was a study, it was done in pediatrics, and they looked at all of these polysomnograms. And what they discovered is, and this is one of the reasons that if you come for a sleep study to specifically rule out those rare conditions, we actually do check like a tox screen to make sure that there's no evidence of THC in the system, is very specifically because you can have sort of a hangover effect. It causes you to feel more sleepy. And in fact, it will cause a false positive on that test. So we need to have people that don't have any of those things in their system so that when we test you, we really kind of know that there's truly a separate sleep disorder and not really sort of a side effect of the medication. So I found that kind of fascinating that in your paper, you were reviewing that, you know, seeing if there would be a medicinal purpose for those types of disorders. If I may, because I know we got to wrap up, I can't steal all of your time. It seems to me, if I'm to summarize this correctly, that insomnia, jury's still out, but there is some data, especially based on what your study showed, that people really did subjectively, meaning they felt that they slept better. And that sort of correlated with the actigraph data. So data in real time seemed to also support that. That's about the strongest data we got, I think. I mean, obstructive sleep apnea, it sounds like there were some promising studies, but really a lot, really nothing definitive there as a way of actually treating, basically reducing the number of events per hour is what we're talking about. We talk about treating obstructive sleep apnea. REM behavior disorder, I got really excited. I saw that there was a really, you know, small, almost a little bit more than anecdotal, but sort of anecdotal evidence about REM behavior disorder. And then doesn't look like it panned out from what I can tell. There needs to be a lot more study. So we can't definitively say that's great for that. Folks, when we talk about REM behavior disorder, it's basically a disorder that happens in rapid eye movement sleep. You, I, all of us, we're paralyzed in rapid eye movement sleep, but our brains are super active. And that's why when I wake you up and you're in REM sleep, you're usually going to recall having a dream. People who have REM behavior disorder, we often see this linked to neurologic conditions like Parkinson's disease. So neurodegenerative diseases is what we call them. And Parkinson's is just but one of them. And what happens is you actually punch and kick and act out your dreams. They're usually very active dreams and people can kind of tell you about them. So the idea is we don't want you punching, kicking your partner, falling out of bed, hurting yourself. When we see these behaviors, we want to be able to treat it. And one of the postulated ideas was that maybe cannabis could be helpful for that. But still, again, the jury's out. It seems to me, to conclude, if we may, with this point, that probably the best data is for post-traumatic stress disorder, at least based on the review that I read with you. I don't know if you would agree with that statement. So please correct me if you wouldn't, but it seemed like maybe there is slightly more robust data for that.
There's more. It's more consistent. In terms of the robustness of the data, it's perhaps debatable because it's self-report still. Perhaps there is nothing better than self-report for people with post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's actually nightmares related to post-traumatic stress disorder. And that is actually all we've got to go on. And does it matter if there is no objective measure for nightmares related to post-traumatic stress disorder? Yeah, you're probably right. It's definitely the more consistent. The other area I think that is consistent, but it's only based upon case series, is restless leg syndrome. I think that that's such an exciting area. It's unexplored. If anyone wants to fund a trial, I'd love to do it. The case series data suggests that cannabis, so people were smoking cannabis, that has quite a powerful effect in either attenuating or completely abolishing symptoms of restless leg syndrome, which for some people can be so debilitating, where they have that urge to move their legs. Whatever the sensation is, it's creeping, crawling, itching, tingling, and it's the sensation worsens in the evening and or afternoon, evening, nighttime, is so powerful that it makes them want to move their legs. It's the only thing they can do to stop it. Then it stops them from sleeping, because if they're moving their legs, if they're getting up to walk around to try and get rid of that sensation, then they're not sleeping. For some people, they've tried so many strong medications that have so many other consequences, yet they can't function because of their restless leg syndrome. Yeah, so I think that there's potential there to have an effective therapy.
That is such a great point. I completely blanked on restless leg syndrome. So anybody who's had restless leg syndrome, think about it as like, you know, sort of that urge that we talk about. You will have this restless feeling. It occurs primarily at night, though, for some people, depending, can occur a little bit earlier in the day. And it is relieved by actually moving around. And you described it beautifully, Jen. You're right. You're right. So insomnia is kind of a maybe, but subjectively, your study, at least I think, was one of the more robust ones that suggested at least people are kind of subjectively feeling better. Not that we're going to go write prescriptions for everybody. The restless legs, you're right. It was interesting because some people were like, I didn't do anything. There was another report. It was like somebody who just had CBD and no THC actually did okay with their restless legs too. So the jury's still out, but you're right. Restless legs for sure. And maybe PTSD, I think. So the answer is a maybe, guys. It's a maybe. So we're not saying no, but you can see how difficult it is to really be able to give yes, no answers to all of this. So hopefully you can appreciate the challenge we have in trying to describe it and try to be really true, fair as much as we can and try to give you a balanced viewpoint. So just be mindful of all those things. And, you know, guys, be careful out there. We did not touch base too much on this, but I will, you know, at least for me, finish with, we didn't get into, do you take it orally, how it's absorbed, vaping, smoking, all of those things. As a pulmonologist, I have to do my PSA. And that would be that there is a real entity. It's either e-cigarette or vaping induced acute lung injury. And we call that EVOLI for short. That is a real entity. So you have to be on the lookout for those vaping products. It may be something component in the vaping products, like vitamin E acetate was one of the components that was named, but it still occurs and it can still happen. So you need to be on the lookout for that. And that is the problem with that. That's an acute injury. So literally you can get scarring in the lung that can happen quite quickly with that. The COPD data is sort of interesting because Donald Tashkin's data from way back when demonstrated chronic bronchitis. So people do get a chronic inflammation and mucus production. That is not uncommon with smoking it for sure. older adults more recently in 2023, I came across a study, looked at older adults, and they may be at increased risk, especially if they have sort of chronically consumed via inhalation marijuana products. So just be aware that if you're going to choose a path, kind of save your lungs if you can, maybe pick a different way, but just understand that that different, you know, absorption through the gut, for example, you may need to figure out the timing and how you respond to that may vary. It's not going to be sort of that quick fix, if you will, that you get with inhalation. Maybe that's not the right term because I'm making it sound like you're getting a fix from the marijuana. That's not what I meant, but you get it. You get it. Last words, Jen, what do you want people to know?
I always finish with the same as what you've just said. We really need more evidence in a broader population and, you know, robust measurement techniques. But the big thing is the route of delivery. I think that, you know, we need an innocuous route of delivery. It's something for people to bear in mind.
Oh, I got to put my pulmonary hat on one last time. Oh, it was so fun. Thank you. I am very much appreciate your time. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. This is so cool. And if you ever want to talk about anything else, please, by all means, I'm here. Hello to all my fellow sleep biohackers out there. I have a call to action for you. If you are enjoying this podcast, if you feel that you are growing, you're more knowledgeable, you're feeling empowered about your sleep, that is the purpose. So please, please take the time to like and review the podcast, share it amongst your friends and family. Please follow me. If you'd like to follow me on Instagram or Facebook, I am there as well. My handle on Instagram and TikTok is AskTheSleepMD. And you can also go to my website, AskTheSleepMD.com, for more information about each of these episodes. We will be sharing with you cited articles that you can actually refer to and read yourself if you like, and lots of juicy tidbits about how to sleep better. Thank you. This podcast is made possible with the exquisite talents of Mr. Joey Salvia, my producer, Mr. Adrian Pederath, my creative director, and music by Lori Kunzel of KunzelMusic.com. Disclaimer: the statements made on this podcast have not been evaluated by the U.S. Food or Drug Administration. They are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. The information provided by this podcast should not be used as individual medical advice. While I am a practicing sleep provider, I am not your sleep provider. You should always consult with your personal healthcare provider for individual recommendations and treatment.